We're going to be talking about brothers on this one, Eddie. So, welcome everybody to... What are you guys talking about?
What are you guys talking about?
Well, welcome everybody to another episode of What Are You Guys Talking About? We are sticking on the Benson and Moorhen bandwagon here, folks. Yes, today we are talking about The Endless, which happens to be After Midnight wasn't a film that they actually, like, they didn't direct that film. They produced it, but they weren't involved actually in the directing of it. But this is a film they have directed and acted in, so we're going to be talking about whether Eddie liked this one a little bit better than After Midnight or not. We'll talk about some of the great cast and crew. I did have a chance to listen to, at least briefly, the director's commentary on this. And thank you, Benson. Thank you, Moorhead, on that, and Mr. Lawson. You know, the three of you just give so much info in the first 10 minutes alone. More people should be doing I think it was a podcast they were doing, but more people should be doing behind the scenes like that. It was So more than what I would say, go see the film. I would say go see the film, and then if you can get it on iTunes or you can get it on the DVD, get the director's commentary, and you will literally hear how they built the film. That's so rare that an indie director will do that and walk you through, this is how we did this, this is how we did that, this is how much we paid for this. You know, they won't give you exact figures on the budget. Was the only bit that I couldn't get, but everything else was kind of whatever you want to know. So
I'm super curious, if you had to have a guess, what do you think it cost?
Yeah, I mean, it's classed as micro budget, so that means it's sub 100,000.
Oh wow, holy shit, looks so good.
Yeah, like that's what I mean. Like, I don't know if that was just how do I say it? Like, someone misspoke or didn't do it properly. I don't really know. You know, why it was classed as micro budget? Because I was like, if they made that for less than 100K,
yeah.
But I'll get into that because they have a large discussion about budget when they discuss on the director's commentary when they discuss the film. So it's one of those things that we will revisit in the discussion. But before we get to that, let's get to the brass tacks just very quickly. You are listening to us on SoundCloud FM, which we're going to stay on for a little while before moving to Anchor FM, which is free. So that's pretty much the only reason we're moving, because why pay for storage if they'll give it to me for free? But as it stands now, you can get all of our episodes on SoundCloud. The podcast is broadcast on the RSS feed to iTunes or Apple Podcasts, as it were now. It's also available on Podbean. Player FM is another one that I use occasionally to get a couple of different things, and pretty much any other platform you can think of. If there is one out there, and you say, well, I listen here and you're not on there, we're more than willing to kind of feed it into the RSS feed, but it should be there. Social media, you can catch us on Facebook, where we have our names and the company page, Love Victoria Productions. Then you also have Instagram with Jazzy J. Shiro and Anano LVP, Twitter with Ananoski Productions or Ananoski Prod, and Mouth Love Victoria. And then obviously LinkedIn, we have each have a page and a company page as well. And we're always posting. As I said, one of the cooler things we're doing right now, and I will talk to you about it at the end of this show, is we put out Eddie's A Cold Soul, which was his second film, if I remember correctly, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, man, it's a good one. Film noir, baby. Film noir. Always really good with that. So, and it's part of, like, I've in the background kind of formed, I mean, I haven't formed it into a company yet, but I have an inkling that I'm going to form a distribution company that's going to form part of our production company, because I may want to self-distribute some stuff from us. Watch that space, because that's a big business decision for us, and I've got to kind
of... That's how A4 started, right?
A24.
A24,
yes, on much bigger deals than what I'm talking about, but yeah, like they there was some movie they were trying to get released, and so they went to they thought they had a lock on certain markets, and that's how distribution works, saying that we can always go to these markets and produce and we'll make money off that. So yeah, their first couple, they just picked up a couple indies that weren't being distributed anywhere else and gave them a home. So I'd love to be able to do that, guys. But as I said, as of today, I have no idea how that's done. So as it stands, we have a title, you know, a company name, and we have some of Eddie's old work that we're re-releasing. But other than that, that's the extent of our distribution company today. Long may it grow larger. So,
well,
but all,
everything starts small, right?
Well, and that's kind of the path we've been on. I'd also encourage you all to go on the website and watch the sizzle reel. It's really... it was a passion project for me, done in a day, believe it or not, because I just wanted to thank... You know, everybody that's kind of been there for us over the past 4 years now, it's been, I mean, I really did tear up a lot when I put it together, Ed, because it was like, I couldn't believe all the stuff we've done. And I really do mean that. We've got so much more to show you guys. Like, it's coming. Like, it's... Ed and I had about an hour-long discussion before we even got on this podcast, just trying to figure out how do we get all these projects done. And COVID is not helping with that. But we're going to get there, guys, and you'll definitely have more content from us on the way. But let's get cracking with the Endless. Ooh, I'm excited. Ooh, I'm excited. Eddie, first impressions. Yeah.
Well, the Endless is essentially a story about two brothers who grew up in a cult and somehow got away. But the younger brother kind of, he misses it, or he has slight fonder memories than the older brother.
Right.
And they receive a package that has a tape on it, and it makes them believe that this cult is going to all, you know, commit suicide. Mm. Kind of like Jamestown and stuff like that. But, or Jonestown, sorry. The premise was good. I really liked the premise. But, you know, it felt like, and I mean this in the most complimentary way possible, it felt like a really good episode of X-Files. Or, okay, like, The Twilight Zone, or just, like, a great mystery story with supernatural or alien elements to it. And I thought of you on the opening crawl, because they had a quote at the beginning, and I know you like your quotes at the beginning of films.
It's becoming my signature, which is a bit dumb because you're told never to do that, but I like doing it, because I think for me, and it's a good point to bring up, because I just started putting it into another one when I was doing the trailer for Prisoner Run A7. I have another quote that went in front of there, and I started realizing I do it in front of all my films. But I guess for me, everything is borrowed. Like, I'm never going to tell you that any idea that I came up with was original. I'm sorry. Like, I just don't believe it is. I'm a kind of person that believes I'm historically retelling you stories from the past. And so that's why they reference that opening title scene. Is interesting because they reference Lovecraft, which I love Lovecraft, so that's awesome. But if you notice, then they also gray out the unknown. And then for the next statement, which is about a brother only tells you the truth on death. I mean, that's the extent of what the quote says. That is by the gray unknown. So you had to read the first quote, and then you're supposed to link it in and say, what if that person was the person who said that? You know what I mean? What if they're referring to that? Now, I mean, that's all a bunch of skullduggery and cumfuckery. You know what I mean? Like, the problem I have with that is, like, no one's really going to follow that the first time through. And it wasn't in the commentary either.
It does. It's not even in the commentary.
No, I just noticed it because I had paused at that moment to go get some food or something like that. And I was like, oh, wait. And so then I looked, and then, of course, I Googled it. And it was like, it is meant to be linked up that way, because the unknown and the unknown. I hear what you're saying. Like, I'm going to push you further on that. Was it better than, like, a Sci-Fi Channel movie?
Yes. Quality-wise.
Okay.
I thought the performances were quite good as well. I'm not going to say, like, award-worthy good, but very naturalistic. Nothing felt too hammy.
That's right. So Benson plays the older brother, and Moorhead is the younger one. Those are the two.
Other way around. Justin Benson plays Justin, who's the younger brother.
Oh, sorry, and sorry.
Aaron Moorhead plays Aaron, who's the older brother.
Okay, sorry, I got that wrong in the commentary then, yeah. Very cool, though. But yeah, I mean, and they talk a lot about, interestingly enough, the section that you'll want to listen to with that is in the bunk bed scene. There's a really good discussion by them in the commentary about that was the test shooting to see whether they could film it and act in it at the same time. So they weren't sure whether it would work or not. And then they did that scene, the bunk bed, where they're talking to each other. There's a bit of a comedy gag, if I remember, that goes on for that.
Are you awake? I was.
Yeah, so that was the test. Apparently that was shot really early on in the production of this thing, just so that they could see whether it would be possible or not.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, anything else for first impressions, Ed, then?
I gotta say, like, one of the things that really caught my eye was their use of wide-angle lenses. Again, because you've been talking a lot about it recently. And I just really noticed with these, even, you know, tracking shots, like Steadicam shots, they were using super wide lenses, and it does do something really, really interesting.
I think it works. Like I think especially in the location. So this is kind of like a Area 51, New Mexico, California looking type place. So you've got lots of, it's very warm, very bright, not too much darkness that you really see. Even at night, you know, you're wooded, so it's a campfire. And so you've got that kind of going on. I think all of that, when you've got that explosion of light that way, Ed, then I think the wide angle lenses lead better to that. I think if you've got really dark shots, then it just unfortunately ends up looking even darker because you're just filling the screen. Do you know what I mean? But I totally get it. They love a two shot. There was so many two shots that were good. See, a two shot, in my view, can be really boring if you don't do it right. And it can be, you know, you can definitely get two on the camera and then just position it the wrong way or let it run for too long so where it just looks like you're, you know, this is all you're going to get. There's no action to it. Whereas their two shots always set up a really good set of close-ups right after it. But they don't stay in the close-ups, like you said. They go back to the two shot or they go back to the wide shot, which is, I think that's what's really different from what you'd normally see. Again, today, from what I understand, Ed, you know, the most popular shot is the close-up with the fuzzy background, which there were plenty of those. But I completely agree with you that the wide-angle lens and the openness of some of the shots was really cool. Especially, like, oh, man, like, I mean, my favorite stuff will always be, like, the aerial shots and stuff on this one, which I know is...
They were really cool.
But I, you know, there was this obsession with circles because obviously it's called The Endless, right? So in the director's commentary, they do a really good job of pointing out to you every time they've thrown one in the background and you just, you know, for shits and giggles. So very cool. So, all right. Well, moving on a little bit on this then. So, Ed, did you like this one better than After Midnight?
I think that this was more my kind of movie. Whereas After Midnight, I would say, is like a romantic monster movie, which neither of those are kind of squarely in my wheelhouse. Whereas this is like, you know, sci-fi, brothers, like it connected quite easily with me.
Yeah, yeah.
But again, like I said when I watched, when we talked about After Midnight, like it looked great, and these guys know how to make a film, which is not something that you can't always say that about indie filmmakers, you know, early on in their career. I think about the Duplass brothers, you know, who were a massive part of the mumblecore thing, and you know, their films, granted they were made at a time when the technology was just not as widely available to shoot something that looks good. But these guys know how to make a film look good.
Yeah, I mean, so walking you through a little bit on production, and if I rant too much here, Ed, just cut me off, because I'll walk you through kind of what I learned about Benson and Moorhead more in production. So this was their third film. Their first film, which is a film, I want to say it's called Rehab, and it's not. It was a knockout success at Tribeca. And it's called Resolution. That's the name of it. It's a very small film. It's got, I think, all of three people in it. And actually, the really interesting point from Resolution, why we should go back and watch it, Ed, is there's actually a connected story between Resolution and The Endless. It exists in the same world. And so they talked about that briefly because people were thinking that The Endless was a sequel to that. And like, no. That's Resolution's about two brothers with one of them trying to get the other off of, I think it's crack. And I'm pretty sure I've seen that one. I'm not 100%, but I'm pretty sure. And it does feel exactly like The Endless. They have this really good low budget indie vibe that they do in their films. And so Resolution is paid for by the brothers, like not by the brothers, by Benson and Moorhead, who aren't brothers, but they one of the two of them self funds that by basically saving up all his pennies. So that's the first one. And I mean, they did it right. They knock it out and try Becca. But then the second film, which is my favorite of theirs, at least of the ones I've seen, which is a movie called Spring. It's another semi-romance with a really cool twist, just a really, really cool twist. And it takes place in Italy, which is beautiful. Now, in the commentary, they were like, well, we should have got money for that. Like, our first film was good. We expected Spring would definitely have some funding. Didn't happen. So they fund that one by remortgaging Benson's dad's place. Yeah, I mean, it happens, right? And I mean, Spring is good. Like, it's really good. So The Endless, they had the idea. They go to Dave Lawson, the producer, and they're like, Dave, we're just going to make this film anyway. And Dave's like, you can't keep doing this, guys. So Dave went out and tried to find them funding and then found it from a film fund called Faff and Faff. So they've done one other film, but it was a tiny little film fund that liked the film. And they picked it up. And so this was the first one where they actually had money. They didn't have a ton of money, from what I understand, because it was always billed as micro-budget. So, again, that suggests at least under $1 million. I would say it's probably less than that. You know what I mean? I think they had much less than that. They talk about openly in the director's commentary how they got around budget constraints on things. And I really, really enjoyed that. So, you know, this will explain After Midnight, too. Do you want to know why you do karaoke? Because you can get away with putting the music in. They didn't pay for all those rights because they're like, we didn't have the money. But if you sing it and you change it enough. So did you notice House of the Rising Sun in The Endless?
Yeah, they never
They never paid a dime for that song.
I was wondering about that. I was like, how did they clear this?
Nope. They talk, and that's why, and Ed, see, he's smiling because he gets it. Like, imagine, like, listening to the first 5 minutes of a director's commentary, which are always great, right? They're always, like, fun in one way or the other. And then literally him singing it and him saying, so, we didn't get the money for House of the Rising Sun. We were never going to get that kind of money. And if you want to put these types of songs in, here's how you do it. You make people sing it in a slightly different way, and then they can't sue you for copyright because we found out, and sorry, I should clarify, because they clarify it in the podcast, it's a House of the Rising Sun is actually an old song. It's public domain as a song, but obviously the Animals version is the version that you can't do. And that's true. So you should know this about everything because a lot of people got this confused when I did Dandelions. Public domain songs are fine to use, but you have to find a free performance. Right. Okay, you cannot use London Philharmonic. They get paid for the stuff that they do. Find somebody. There are plenty for classical pieces. You can always find somebody who's done it for free. And I would, you know, I would encourage you to use that if you're an indie director. But for them, this is how they got around it. So they were using the song House of the Rising Sun, but they weren't using the Animals. It was a different enough version. And the way they say it on there, and then there's a bunch of other scenes, Ed, which you would have loved, where they're like, here's this park we were at, and oh, we had a permit for that. Yeah, we definitely had a permit for that. There was no way we didn't have a permit for it. Oh, yeah, there's the crew, there's the composer's kids, because who wants to pay the SGA for actors anyway? It was just like, I'm telling you guys, like, the commentary is as good as the film itself because these are all the things we do. Like, it always makes you smile when you find another indie filmmaker because, trust me, like, I'd love to pay the rights for every song that we need to use. I'd love to pay every location. Given enough money, obviously we would, but when you're given a budget, that's the kind of stuff you have to start thinking around is saying, okay, how do I get around that? And Benson and Moorhead, you know, I have to raise the flag for these guys because they are very talented at it. There are so many things that they do to cut back on cost. So there's certain scenes, Ed, when they were on the camp and they're showing it and they say, these were like the last two shots. They had an 18-day shoot or a 19-day shoot. And they're like, these are the last 2 days of the shots. And you can see there's no extras on screen. Those are all crew pretending to be extras. And they're all just moving around in the background. And I just...
You know what? I'm sorry. You're absolutely right. I just clicked on a link and I'm looking at Justin Benson and he's playing the other one.
I thought you're so, because right. if it makes you feel any better, I always thought Moorhead was the older one and Benson was... For some reason, the names fit the faces the other way around.
Yeah, but
Benson is the older-looking one, and yeah, okay, that's no big deal. I just... now I don't think I'm going crazy anymore. That's good. So I mean, that's why I wanted to go through this, and we may go through Spring. I talked to Ed about saying maybe we do one more. I know we also want to talk about The Mando... we're going to get some more interviews going on as well. And there's also His Dark Materials, which I didn't know, Ed, whether we should do episode 52 with His Dark Materials because that's our official 1 year anniversary. So, do you know, should we go back to the beginning and do at least one on His Dark Materials, season two?
His
I don't know.
Materials thus far.
I don't know. I just, it was cracking me up that we're going to be on a year's worth of episodes. But for today's episode, like, I'm not joking about the fact that just watching these guys' films. And as I said, listening to commentary will take you that much further. Without the commentary, Ed, like, what were some of the things that you noticed that were particularly good from an indie perspective that you would say stood out to you about these guys in The Endless?
I think I was impressed by the performances, especially because, you know, we've talked about directing and acting and how for the most part, I don't think it's a great idea. But, I mean, if they can do it like this, Jesus. Because, you know, they're the main characters in it. Like, they're in 90% of the film. I thought it looked really sumptuous. I don't know what camera they used to film it on.
I know, it's so good. I love that word too. It was sumptuous, wasn't it? It was like, oh, this is a tasty really film. Nice.
And the effects were like really quite good. I don't think they tried to reinvent the wheel in any way with them. But it was really, really quite good. Just everything, the craftsmanship of this film feels really well polished, even though obviously they are at the beginning of their careers, they are working with like lower budgets and stuff like that. And I suppose what made me think, oh, this is clever, is the location. It felt very rural and like the kind of place that they could probably, you know, get permission to film on quite easily. I mean, I could be wrong about that, but it just felt like a clever location to set it in.
Mm, wide open spaces. I know what you mean. So you're not as punched for having people around or trying to get the camera at a particular angle. You know, it's not like I have a dearth of experience either way, but I just am more of a location person than I am studio. That's because I have virtually nil experience in the studio. Mm. So I don't know how quickly they can put together sets, and I don't really have that. And I would like to get the experience. God knows if anybody needs, you know, somebody production assistant or something like that, on one of your studio stuff. But I just, locations you have just have the freedom there. As long as you're allowed to be there, then it's like, well, then you can move around. If you need to change the shots up there. There was a couple, like, so in the rope pulling scene, like, they changed that up in the edit, apparently. And originally, like, it was going to be this big bit about him looking back at the cult leader, who I've forgotten his name, but is apparently a really nice guy and an amazing actor. You know, and that was supposed to be a kind of a confrontation between the older brother and that, them kind of saying, you know, coming down to it, where it ends up being the younger brother is then starting to catch the feels for the woman. You know what I mean? The one that's old enough to be his grandma.
For Anna, yeah.
And so that was interesting because they talk about that. And so when we looked at it, we said, actually, we would kind of like to draw it that way. And you could tell these guys, like, are doing every aspect of it. You know, they were talking about the edit. They were talking about the shooting. They were talking about the art department. And you know, the two girls in the art department, they were like, yeah, we always give them hell, but they're the best people ever. It's just very all-rounders and very dedicated, as you said, Ed, to craftsmanship. So, I mean, I think it's once again, it gets really tired. Even I get tired of hearing it, but it's the two pillars, a quality film and a good script, right?
Yeah, because the story is tight. The story is very, very tight.
So the original concept, and they talked about this because apparently, and I think it's the younger one, so that's Moorhead. Moorhead was saying that he first gave Benson the bad version, and the bad version of this script was one of the favorite scenes by every crowd in it, which I don't know if you caught it, but it's the 1919 loop that happens where that guy, he only has like a single line, but it's repeated eventually. And apparently in the mechanics of the way that works, the closer the loops are together, the shorter the time frame. And so because the loop is, you know, very close, he's literally from one pillar to the other or right next to each other, he just keeps repeating the same loop over and over and over again. But that apparently was the original, like, this is what I'm thinking of, this is what I want to develop out. And he just laughed about it because I called it the bad script, the bad version of what I wanted to do. And then everybody loved that scene. So just kind of interesting how that worked out. But the script was, you know, it's original. It's something I'm not... It's original and it's not. So the heart, again, of this is almost... I almost want to say it's like a doppelganger theme. I always feel cult films are a bit like that, that you've taken normal people and you replace them with cult members. And they did talk about Jonestown. The other one that I don't know if you're familiar with that was really kind of, there were elements all over the place in The Endless Four, it was the Hail Bob cult. Do you remember them? Did you ever hear Hail Bob?
Hail Bob? No, I haven't heard about it.
So there was a comet called Hail Bob. Don't ask me. came around, I believe, at the end of the millennium, or at least a few years beforehand. There was a cult in California that was waiting for the comet to come over them, and when it did, they all committed suicide in unison because they believed the comet contained a spaceship that was going to take them up and take them away. And so they didn't think they were dead. They thought they were all boarding the spaceship. So that opening video that you get just screams of the Hale Bob incident, because that's what happened. We found that, like, the news got the videos, and it was all over the news, just saying, like, 100 people found dead, killed themselves, you know, by poison, all on the same night when the comet went over the top of them. And then you had the video from the really creepy leader. I mean, let me ask you, when did you start figuring out, like, what was going on in this? How late was it into the film?
It was pretty late. I think it was when they went to see... the really angry dude, the guy who was walking, who had hung himself.
Yeah.
I think it's when I saw him, and then he appeared. I guess that's when I realized something was wrong. My keen intellect realized something's up here. But the time loop thing, I think it was quite gradual. I think that's what I found quite pleasing about the mystery element of it, was that. I don't know if there were clues to let someone, you know, catch it early on, but I think that by the time it was revealed what was going on, it was satisfying. It didn't come out of left field. It wasn't contrived.
And that's why, you've got to go get the commentary. I'll come over here and you can come watch it at my house. When COVID's over, when lockdown's over, come over here and you can come watch it at my house. But you will love the fact that they talk about exactly what you're saying. Like, so, and that's why I asked, because I remember them mentioning it. So, like, they would look at a scene and they would say, actually, we cut out a scene you can get in deleted scenes, which we could watch those as well if you came over. But the deleted scenes are like, listen, we had a real problem with this because we didn't want you to know anything, really. We wanted you to keep guessing until we gave the reveal, because the reveal is not what you think it is. Right. You know, because the reveal is that the cult is actually just a really nice group of people that are trapped by this horrible being that just decided that this is what they have to do. And so, you know, they don't necessarily want to do it, but they'd rather not fight it. You know, that's their view to do it the way they do it. But there's nothing sinister about them whatsoever. Like, they just, you know, that's who they are. You know what I mean? And they said, we had all these scenes where we would have started showing you things earlier, but we didn't want you to start thinking. So one of the big changes was, originally, there's a scene where the older one, where Justin, Justin's the older one, right?
Yes.
Yeah, where Justin once, like, is sitting with them, having a good time and feeling happy. And they're like, it was put right before the running scene where he's running. And that's actually the time he's running and runs into the angry guy and can't figure out what the deal's dude is. But right before that scene, apparently, there was the scene where he's just sitting, hanging with them. They're having karaoke. They're having a good time. And he's smiling and thinking, why did I ever leave this place? You know what I mean? Mm. And they said, and we couldn't do that because we needed you to think and we needed him to think, you know, in the progression of the story, there's still something wrong here. There's still something not quite right. So if it all goes happy-dappy in the middle, then the ending, when you find out the the really sinister part has nothing to do with them, loses its impact. So that's why I asked, because I figured that. Because I went through the same thing. At the end, it all made perfect sense to me, but I was like, I didn't guess that at all. Like, I just didn't see that. You know what I mean? So I just wondered how that impacted you.
Really well paced. Really, really well paced.
And again, it goes back to Ed's comments about this being, you know, masterful craftsmanship. That's what we're talking about. It's the devil in the detail. The other thing they talk about is rehearsals. They did a bunch of rehearsals with, you know, because they had a quick shoot on this one. I think it was 18 or 19 days. They did rehearsals in the beginning on this one to make sure everyone knew it. And they also supplied their actors and actresses with full backgrounds, which they made a big comment in the commentary about that, saying, like, listen, we know it's slightly ridiculous to people to say, why do we need to know someone's life story? But they said, you don't understand how that helps the actors come up with decisions on the acting plane. So, again, that's what we're talking about when we see craftsmanship. If you just hand the lines to your actors, you're just like every other director out there, and you might get good results. You may not. If you write backstories and have a thought, you know, to give to your actors as to, this is how I see the character and what I want them to do with them, you're really giving that kind of extra depth and detail that will show up somewhere in the performances. You know what I mean? So, you know, And with that in mind, I will lead to my next question, Ed. Who is your favorite performance in this one? Because these are all like relatively no-name actors, but I love all the actors in this one. I really like the acting performances.
Yeah, I think actually, possibly, so you've got, I quite like Shitty Carl, who was the tweaker. I thought he was really funny. That scene with him and Mike could have been horrible, but actually it worked really well.
I know, right? And like it, very natural, and it shouldn't have been. Like, it was the weirdest thing for him to have to traipse out there, because you're just learning about all these loops and what's going on, and you're not quite sure. So I was worried this was going to be like Crazy Man in a Hut, where you're like, oh, he's the harbinger or something like that. You know, the one that always just seems off his head, and it was just the opposite. It was like they like focused
the normal one.
Yeah,
have you got any drugs? Really? No, seriously, I'm not joking. Have you got any drugs? Can we share them?
All right. Some other cool little bit of tidbits. You know Smiley Dave?
Yeah.
That's Dave Lawson, the producer. He really hated that cameo. He's such a grumpy fuck. He was like, I really hated you guys for making me do that. It was so hard for me to produce and try to do this at the same time. I mean, I don't know if he's just naturally sarcastic like that, but it was hilarious to me that he's like, yep, I had to play the smiling jackass.
What about for you?
Kira Ellis.
Kira Ellis. Oh, Anna. No.
No. Anna's from, she was in the, if you want to see another really good role that she's in, she was in the Blair Witch, the new Blair Witch. Oh. She has a really good performance. Like, Kira Ellis hasn't really been in much anything else, but she plays the crazy one that makes the pictures.
Oh, Lizzie.
Lizzie. I adored that character. I just thought it was so cool and well crafted.
I think maybe Kira Powell. I don't know. I've got Wikipedia open here, and it says Kira Powell as Lizzie, but I don't know. Why did you like her in particular?
Because she was so well cast. Like, you needed something that was fringy, but also someone that could sound really serious at times. Mm. And, like, it's just, again, casting crazy people is fucking hard, okay? Yeah. Like, you know, we heard from Mr. Stovall that McLeod, just in case any of you want to cast crazy people, McLeod does a really good crazy, apparently.
Yeah, but he gets dope cast, right? That's the problem.
Okay, so maybe don't call him if you want crazy. I love it. I'll get an angry tweet from him. You know, I'll be like, you asshole, I don't want to do crazy anymore. But it's tough. You know, it is that great line from Tropic Thunder. You know, and that one's talking, and I can't say that because it'd be rude, and I wouldn't use that word. But it is difficult because you're acting, and so you can't really. She just seemed to me to be this ethereal character, and really made a presence where there shouldn't have been. It's what I liked. She just exemplifies what I liked about the actors in this. There were a lot of, like, no-name actors and I'm sorry, Kira Powell, not saying you're a no-name actress. I'm just saying there were a lot of new talent that had bit parts. Like, that's not a big part that she had, but you really remember her performance. The magician guy was the same way. You know what I mean? Like, I hate that I remember it, but you just... And then there was the older one with the beard. Like, they each have a very distinctive character, even though they're only in the film for however long it is. And I guess that's maybe what I like about Benson and Moorhead, is that I feel like they really utilize their actors. Like, if they've only got five people in a film, they're going to make you remember who those people are. You know what I mean?
I thought that the guy who played Hal, the leader of the cult...
Yes.
I thought he was really good, because inevitably... you kind of focus on that character as the main antagonist. In any movie where there's a cult, whoever's the cult leader, you're like watching him like a hawk. And he straddled that line really, really well of being just like weird, but also not horrible.
Yeah, I mean, again, this is, dude, we're going to have so much fun with this commentary. So they talked about that as well. So they said when they hired the guy that they tend to hire actors and actresses that are naturally playing the parts that they like. Now, I'm not sure I agree with that or not, but it works. So if you hire someone that's going to be the character they're going to be, it certainly makes your life easier. So I can't disagree with that. Like, as much as I mean, it's not like I'm an expert at all at this, but... you know, you can hire people that aren't naturally the people you want them to be. There are some great actors out there. But this guy was, you know, the way that Benson described it is like the nicest guy you'll ever meet. And what they made the point of, and that was interesting that you said this, they made the point, like you are, that it was odd, though. Like, he's that nice, but you don't, not to the point where you hate him because he's so nice. It's just the opposite. Like, he's nice to that.
Just don't trust him.
Exactly. No, no, they said it was just to that point, and that's why they hired him, because they needed the cult leader to seem, you know, overtly nice.
Like a cult leader, right?
So that you kind of have your own misgivings, but he's really just naturally the nicest guy ever.
Yeah.
Now, the only interesting tidbit I found out about this actor, and if you could just give the name, because I'm terrible with names, and I'm really sorry about that.
Tate Ellington.
There we go, Tate Ellington, because they talk about you a lot in the commentary, and they said that Tate had more questions in between shoots than any other person they'd ever seen before. However, and this is important, however, they answered every single one of the questions because they thought they were important to him. So this guy impressed them so much that even though he would waste, like... And it's not, I guess, wasted time, but he would take time in between the shots, which for a director and a producer can be like, no, we need to get moving, you know, and ask questions. Every time they gave him an answer, he incorporated that into his performance more. So again, it's just you're dealing with, it sounds like, and I consider Ed to be like this as well, actors, directors, two guys that understand how to get the most out of their people. I would say as an indie director, and this is just, again, a producer, someone who looks at the money, talking about what works best, that is probably one of your best routes as an indie director, is being an acting director. Because if you can get solid performances out of your people, it makes up for a lot of money you don't have.
Right, absolutely.
So, I you know, that's it's always the two pillars, great writers and decent actors. And then all of a sudden we'll get a film together for nothing. You know what I mean? So, masterpiece theater. So, what other questions to ask before we wrap this up and I move on to your film?
Can I ask one?
Oh, you can ask as many as you want, dude.
How would you classify this film? I mean... Okay, like, it's called sci-fi horror. Is that what it is, do you think?
I the horror bit gets in there because I think they don't want it to just be sci-fi. The problem with sci-fi as a classification is a genre, and I fully get behind this. It's a really good question, Ed, because I'm going to rant! Like, listen, why is it, everybody, and I sound like Dennis Miller the minute I say that, why is it that the minute someone says sci-fi, like, 50% of the room just runs in the other direction? Like... I don't get it, guys. Like, it's just science fiction. It's cool. Like, and don't get me wrong, you don't have to be like a badge-wearing Star Trek aficionado to like sci-fi.
No,
so,
especially not this kind of sci-fi.
And that's what I mean. I think that's why the slash horror is added on. This could be pure sci-fi. You know what I mean? People die in sci-fi films all the time. It's like they do that with District 9 as well. District 9 is a sci-fi film. It's not a horror film. It's a sci-fi. Yeah. There's no real tension like a horror film's supposed to build, you know, in that element. Or no... You know, again, it's when you go down to like the Save the Cat kind of memes with the different types of story. There's no Monster House going on in District 9, like, as far as I can tell. I don't think. Now that I say that, now I'm going to check. But, yeah, the slash horror in Endless, I think, is because you have some hangings and you have some things, but it's horror light, you know what I mean? It's very horror light.
I mean, like, my mum, I think, would enjoy this.
Yeah, when I think that was the idea, this was, if I understand correctly, the most successful of the three films. It grossed just under $1 million in the box office and another 300,000 with DVD sales. And the DVD sales were actually quite substantial for this one, where, you know, I'm a guy that goes to, you can go to this website called The Numbers, it will give you all this stuff. And I would tell you, normally when I see DVD sales, even for like the best of businesses, you know, it's usually 70 or 50. This had 300, you know what I mean? 300 that they made through DVD sales. So the total was like 1.3 million that they made off the film.
Okay. So successful film?
I think so. If it was made as a micro budget, which was under $1 million, it means they've at least made back their money on the film. So for an indie director, that is... kind of the bare minimum. I mean, you're gonna make a film, God knows, and this isn't from my experience, this is from my friend's experience, because I talked to them all. Everybody makes a film that does badly, okay? Everybody. Even the good ones make really bad films sometimes. That's part of the art part of it. Sometimes you know, sometimes you don't. But for this one, it was a good film, it grossed enough, and it paid back the people that gave the money, so, yeah, I mean, they did their next one, had a much bigger budget, was called Synchronic. Now, unfortunately, I did not know that was there, so I did not watch it at Fright Fest. I don't remember it getting any ridiculously awesome reviews. Yeah. But you know what, Ed? We might have opened for that.
For Synchronic, really?
Oh, man. No, I think we did. Oh, this is going to be one of those podcast moments, because this is what I'm like, guys. I'm going to call Benson Moorhead and be like, hey, man, I opened for your film, but I'm sorry I got busy with the meeting, so I couldn't watch it. Because we were really stoked and crazy about the Ghost Waits one, yeah. Because I knew Adam and I'd met him before. Oh, that's going to kick me. This is when, as a producer, you're like, epic fail. You opened for you opened for two directors you think are awesome, and you didn't even drop them a line. So, yeah, but their latest was Synchronic. Like I said, it had... If it's the one I'm thinking of, the one that we opened for on the Monday, it was kind of a how did they describe it? It was a superhero film, you know what I mean? Okay. Kind of different ways, but it had a much higher budget than The Endless did, so there was money more like sci-fi factors into that one. We'll definitely have to go give it a watch at some point, but I will wait for it to come out and on iTunes. And if we did open for you on that one, I'm really sorry. Like that, we were so blown out from the night before. You know, opening our first time debut, I was very excited and chasing people on it, so I'm pretty sure that's why I didn't watch the film, if I remember correctly, but sorry. I watched my film, and then I left the room. Sorry, I just feel in the back of my head them being like, well, you stayed for the other kids' performances, and I'm like, I'm really sorry. I'm always so busy during... That's the only disadvantage of the online film festivals, is because I'm promotion up the yang, like... I just can't sit still. I have to be talking to someone. I have to be trying to get a meeting together, or, you know, trying to get some conversations with people. And, you know, I'm the kind of person, I talk like I have all these high level meetings too, by the way. They're not really high level. Like, I think that's the other thing I should point out to anyone listening to this podcast, because you may get the impression that I like, I don't know. I the meetings I have, man, are very much, you know, two people chatting over the phone over a cool idea. And then it's later that I call those people back and say, so I've got a really good idea now. We work with me. But you've always got to lay the groundwork. And that's something I learned in my day job. And so that's why, rambling on even further here, I would say those online film festivals do represent a good opportunity for any indie filmmaker, really, to go out and kind of reach out to people there and make connections that you can later pull on later. But I'll stop rambling now. So Eddie Spaghetti, any other questions on The Endless? Anything else burning that mind of yours? Things you'd like to know?
No, I thank you. Thank you for suggesting this one. Like, I had never heard of these guys, and like after we'd done After Midnight, I was like, okay, we'll do another one. We'll check it out. But I was fucking over the moon with this. This is really up my alley.
Again, you know, for me, I can tend to almost sometimes be too focused on things. But this, to me, a lot of what I'm watching right now when I'm progressing is Ed and I trying to look at things that look a lot like what we want to do. This is, at least when I looked at it, Ed, a film that we would want to do. For that budget, for everything, you know. If I don't think it'll be our first film, which is a shame, because I'd love to have almost a million, you know, for the first film. But we just, you know, that's not how it works, guys. And everyone will tell you that. Like, we got to make the film that's mega low budget first, that does well. And then you get to make the one that's a couple hundred grand or a million. And then you get to move up. Usually. I mean, that's what we're told. So, but as far as a film I would like to make, I looked at this one and said, yeah, I could make this film. I think it would be great. Like, I think small, you know, the things you can tell it's indie, small cast, the VFX are not absent, but minimal. You know what I mean? There's no great flying saucers or anything like that going on. It impressed me in the same way that, and it is a better film, no offense whatsoever to my Chilean brother there, but to that film, what was it that I said? It wasn't Autopsy. It was the X-Files film I watched. The one that everyone else was like, oh, it was so terrible, because it had no English subtitles. Oh,
the subtitle one, yeah. I can't remember.
Alien Autopsy or something like that. It was awesome. But it was, the reason it was awesome is because I loved it, because you could totally tell the Chilean director had no, I mean, he told me he had like €5,000 for the whole thing. And I'm like, that's genius. Like, if I can make a film for €5,000, like, holy shit, man, I'd have so much fun.
Amazing. Did you ever watch Primer, the Shane Carruth film?
No, what's that about?
It's a 2004 film, and it was very famous at the time because it was shot on a GH2.
Oh, okay.
Which is like the granddaddy of your...
my G80. Yeah.
It is a time travel movie, and it was very, very well received. And obviously, it's 2004, so, you know, again, a different time for stuff like that. But it kind of made me think of it, because it's about time travel as well.
No, and I think, Ed, you've really got Yeah, sometimes you just know the kind of stuff that's on my mind without me having... Because I haven't actually mentioned this, Dad, but like I go out every day with my G80, every single day, and just shoot a couple things, because it's fun, and because I've got this 600-pound camera that I've got to use now, you know what I mean? But what really gets me, because I'm always new to everything, is like, I cannot understand what the quality of the picture that comes out of that, because once you put it on the Final Cut Pro, and you do it up a bit, like, you can make it look just like a... I don't know if I want to say a 35 millimeter, but you know what I mean? Like I'm not that talented with Final Cut Pro, but I can make it look pretty freaking good pretty quickly. Like, it doesn't take much to make it look straight. Like, dude, you guys that are wondering, how do I make a film? Like, I'm already like, if I just shot this corner 100 different ways, how can I make a story about that? If I just did that time travel, I was thinking like, what VFX loops and things like that can I do really cheap and turn it into a full story? Because then all I need is that freaking camera. Like, it's so portable and it's so easy. And God knows I'm the person that was already shooting on my Pixel 3. So God knows why I had to, you know, upgrade to a camera like that. But I guess that's my point, is you don't need money. You need concepts and you need creativity. And then, like, I don't know. I just say, get a camera like that and be less afraid. Come out with a 20-minute something or other that you want to do, and don't submit it to film festivals. Just put it on your own. But always be working on that stuff, because eventually you're going to get that 5,000, 6,000, 10,000 idea that says, guess what, man? You know what I mean? You're going to take a minimal amount of equipment. Hmm. I mean, I'm always excited. You know, LVP, we have 3 cameras. So I'm like, man, we should be able to make something with those 3.
Technically 5. I have an old DSLR in my GoPro.
Oh, man. That's just crazy. You know what I mean? So who needs camera rental with that? And then I still tell them, you think we should rent?
Problem is, you look at some of the newer cameras and you're like, yeah, we should rent.
Well, and it also, I mean, this is where you get into the camera porn stuff. So on those discussions, like, sometimes it's like, oh, do I just want to shoot it on an Arri or a Red? You know what I mean? Or do I just want to... The problem is, Ed's got a Blackmagic Pocket, which every time I see the footage from a Blackmagic, like, I'm always pleased with it. So, you know what I mean? But, you know, we shot, what, Give Me a Reason, we shot on a Sony, wasn't it?
Yeah. And what did we shoot Shredders on?
That I don't remember, because it wasn't, because that was, Ricky had the camera for that one. Do you remember what Ricky, because he had a Steadicam for that, didn't he?
Did he have an Ursa? Was it, it might have been an Ursa Mini.
That sounds really familiar, so yeah, it could be. I just remember that huge, that poor guy, Ricky, legend amongst men, wore like a Steadicam rig for 3 days straight, and like, let me tell you, that's not easy work.
Yeah, that easy rig doesn't help that much, and he was very sweaty by the, I mean, we all were,
yeah. Let's be honest. Great job on it, you know what I mean? Another really proud. But yeah, I think you did say it was an Ursa. Is it an Ursa you said? Ursa?
Ursa Mini, I think.
That sounds right to me. Yeah. So that's another thing that comes into all of this. And I'm very thankful to Ed for opening my eyes to kind of the selection with that. It's a really beautiful thing, because it's not like one is necessarily better than the other. It's just, what are you going for? You know, do you want super squeaky clean? Do you want something that does well? You know, the Panasonic I bought because its ability in low light, because I live in a forest. So most of my shots are going to be done either early morning or late night when the sun is going somewhere else. I did take it out midday with Catherine on Saturday. And I mean, it does all right. But, you know, then you're dealing with the flares and everything else and the crowds of people. So, you know, the camera I bought was suited, so if I want to shoot something close and shoot something quick, I've got something that'll work for it. But, you know, for example, Ed, what are the particularly great qualities of a Blackmagic, a Blackmagic Pocket? What makes that distinctive versus the other competition?
For me, the dynamic range is massive, so that means that the light stops that you are filming at have more latitude to be manipulated, so you can darken things better, you can lighten things better.
Okay.
There's also the color space for the Blackmagics is really, really nice. So a full color space, like cinema camera, is 444.
Right.
A lot of the DSLR cameras are 400.
And it's a problem with the Micro Four Thirds. I have a Micro Four Thirds. This is what the Panasonic is. It's an issue for them as well. I think
it is. It's actually, my Blackmagic is Micro Four Thirds.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, but it's got more to do with the chip, the sensor.
Ah, okay.
Which obviously, you know, is affected like by its size, but the color space on a Blackmagic is 422, which is, again, it's not the highest, but it's closer, much higher quality to the full color space, and it just gives you a lot of ability to manipulate things in post and do color correction and color grading and
because we have time, and because I'm being honest, because I'm also a student, so Ian Rattray found it really interesting this week when I was reading my very old Guerrilla Filmmakers Handbook, and he is in there as the film booker. So I shot the picture of it and shoot it over to him on Messenger and just said, "Hey there, handsome." And he was cracking up. He's like, "How old is this?" I'm like, "Well, it was a used book that I bought, blah, blah, blah." Now, the question I'm going to ask you, and you might have foreseen it coming, but can you explain, because I remember reading it, I remember seeing the pictures and still not really understanding 444 and 422. What is that talking about? Do you know?
So, I'm no expert, certainly, but as far as I understand it, it's the color space, which means the sensitivity of the sensor that is in your camera and its ability to collect more color than your naked eye can see.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, skin tones are made up of lots of different colors, mm-hmm. right? And with a high color space of 444 or 422, for example, you're capturing more of the nuance in color in skin tones.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially, I can then turn around and manipulate the colors so I could turn you into the Hulk if I'm recording you here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you're not cooking it into the image that you record,
right? And if I understood correctly, I think that's where the 2.2 comes in, because you always start from the four basis. Again, is talking about bit rate, I believe, and how many bits of, again, I should be good with this stuff because I normally don't understand, but the initial outlay is there, and then it's going to be converted. The 2.2.2 is converting it into smaller packages, so you're losing some of the color there.
Right. Yeah. Exactly right. And it also makes it a little bit harder, because an image straight out of a Blackmagic doesn't look great. It looks very flat. It doesn't look like there's any color or vibrancy to it.
So this would be like the raw footage, right?
Exactly, yeah. But once you get it into the editors, the color graders, whether it's DaVinci or Final Cut or Adobe, you then have a lot of latitude. When I shot A Cold Soul, which we're going to talk about a little bit later, I used my GH2.
Okay.
And again, same camera that they used for Primer, but Primer looks a lot better than mine does.
I don't know. that's actually a really good segue, because we got about 10 minutes left, and we were talking earlier, and Ed and I were having production discussions. Well, I put them up for you, Ed, so people can see them. But really, I should be very honest, and I'm putting this up for everybody, because every time I watch them, like, it just kind of pisses me off that I kept them. It wasn't me deliberately keeping them, but we kept them under wraps for so long. When Ed, you've made some great films, man, some really great films. You know what I mean? And it's just, that's cool to me that, like, the world finally gets to see this. Because these were things that I remember. Like, I remember these two coming out. So, How the Heart Was Lost and A Cold Soul coming out pretty close to one another and struggling. I think you had three at Raindance at the same year. And you were like, you've got to vote for one. I'm like, oh, can I vote for all three? I don't know, man. Like, it's tough. And obviously, I voted for How the Heart Was Lost, because that's my favorite. But without further ado, and without me talking any further, tell us about A Cold Soul. Start us out with kind of concept and where you came up with the idea for it.
Sure. So after I filmed Perfect, which was my first short film, which was a kind of sci-fi drama, I decided that I kind of wanted to make something that my mum would enjoy.
Mm.
Mostly because she had been such a massive influence on my film tastes, and so I immediately went to Detective Story, because that's what we had enjoyed growing up watching together, whether it was Remington Steele or Jessica Fletcher or Poirot, Miss Marple, whatever. Like, we love our detective stories.
You do. I mean, I sit regularly on this side, Ed. I bought it for her actually during Fright Fest for all the help she gave me that weekend to let me kind of do my thing, I bought her the entire Poirot collection.
Oh, nice.
Only partially because Poirot looks just like my dad. He really does. David Suchet with a mustache looks just like my dad. But yeah, and I have to tell you, I can see where you like it. You know, there's a semblance of it's just fun. You know what I mean? I mean, it's always the Poirot Hastings things that I love. But do you know what I mean? Like, there's a simplicity to those stories, man. That's really cool.
Yeah. So that's when I kind of came up with this character, Sam Wright, who was named after both Humphrey Bogart and his famous Sam character in The Maltese Falcon and stuff like that, and also Edgar Wright, who's my favorite director.
So yeah.
That's how I came up with that. But the idea was to basically have this guy who was an investigative journalist, ended up living in Korea, and this is now one of his cases that he's working, right? That's kind of how I envisioned it. But of course, as I want to be, I ended up putting swearing into the film, which meant that my mum wouldn't enjoy it. But no, I really enjoyed it. It was a really tough shoot. I was doing a lot of it on my own. I had the main actor who was also helping produce, Paul Stafford. But I definitely felt that this was the one where I was putting it on my shoulders and, you know, doing everything. I was the cinematographer, I was the writer, I was the director, I was the producer. And would you say,
I think that's a good point, would you say when you're starting out as an indie director, that is kind of your first couple may come out that way, yeah? I mean, would you say that?
Yes, it's not ideal, but it's just the reality of it. It's not knowing, you know, this comes to some of the stuff that we were talking about earlier, but it's not knowing about how to kind of gather people around you and do, like, you know, get people to do things for
you.
It's a very, very difficult thing. And unfortunately, what it means is that particularly early on, you just decide, well, I'm just going to do everything.
Yeah, and I guess you know me. I'm asking because that's kind of the process that I've had to go through. So, like, you know, early stuff where I was collaborating with you guys, you know, it was like, okay, LVP will do this. And then it didn't matter for us to have, you know, a whole crew together because we were just jumping into another group. So Shredders, you know, that was a joint collaboration and we were producers on that. And yeah,
we're part of the crew.
Ed was part of the crew. But, you know, Michael, you know, I'm being honest here. Michael took care of a large part of, because I wouldn't have the first clue to go to for some of these people at that time that was being made. And other things we worked on, you know, we did I Need Some Ideas, Demon Ed. That was our film, but that was literally filmed in this office that I'm sitting in right now, you know, with just us there. And then we got to Dandelions, and Dandelions was this amazing point for me, Ed, where, you know, like, I finally learned how to do the things with a camera that I've been watching for so long. But it was immediately followed, as you've just said, with the shock and horror that it didn't matter, you know, a bottle of piss, because if I can't get five people together to make these films, I can come up with the concepts that and see it in my head and do all these. I can be the most French director in the world, but it doesn't matter because I don't have a film. And that has been really frustrating. So that's why I asked it. And Ed, you're always good at pointing out, I always have an ulterior motive when I ask things, but but that's why I wanted to bring it up, because don't get discouraged, because I've been getting discouraged with that. And it's not the end of the world. You've got to learn to make those connections and find those people. And even Eddie, one of the greater directors that I know in my life, started out the same way.
Well, it's tough as well, because, you know, like in Korea, it was actually easier. It was easier because you had a population of people, most of who had pretty easy jobs.
Yeah.
And were earning decent money, and had time and wanted to do creative things. So it was actually easier. Like, I would bump into 10 actors every day who would be asking me,
can you think of that, right? Like, we made the equivalent, at least I did, made the equivalent of like 25, 30 grand a year working what was it, 4 o'clock to 10 o'clock Monday through Friday?
It's ridiculous.
Like, are you kidding me? Like, yeah. I can make so many films if that was my schedule now.
Yeah. And by the time I was up in Seoul, like, I was in the heart of the expat arts community.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I was living on the street where they had music festivals.
And I guess that's the whole thing that I'm not sure we always explain really well about the expat community in South Korea. Like, only certain kind of people are going to do that. You know what I mean? Only certain kind of people are going to move all the way out there to do that. And there are a lot that do it to become more expressive creatively. You know what I mean? And to kind of have a less of a job to do, either to find themselves or to, you know, do that. We have tons of free time out there. So, and you were a university professor, right? So you even had those summers off. I remember, yeah. I think you told me your schedule once, and it was like you had like 3 months off out of the year. And I was like, man, I've got to find a different job.
It was very, very nice. But again, I think it always kind of comes back to, and I think this is why I brought it up, that there came a point where a lot of that community had developed and was starting to do their own things, and no one had any time for anyone else.
Right.
And then secondly, if you wanted to make the jump into the actual industry, which I did, and I tried to, and I got to work on a few things, I was very, very limited because I didn't speak the language.
No, and I will say that, and this isn't meant to be prejudiced at all, but this is telling you some of the information that I learned from my day job in very high level. So this isn't a particular client or anything like that, but I've worked, you know, pretty much in every country in the world, South Korea being one of them. There are certain areas where you're going to have a harder time breaking in, and that would be an area I would think so, because many of the companies, corporations, and things that are done out there are closed. Like, they don't, you know, the easiest example I could give you is in law. So they only let foreign lawyers into the country like 5 years ago. Before then, foreign lawyers were not allowed to practice in that country. It was only Korean lawyers. That's a really good place where you can check, you know, check how they treat their lawyers, because some countries are really open to having other people in. England tends to be that way. England is one of those places you can come from anywhere and they'll let you do your job here. You can be a lawyer, you can be a director, you can do whatever you want. Other places, and a lot of other places, this isn't specific to Korea at all, are much more protective than that and say, no, you can't come in here and do this. And it's sometimes it comes because the businesses want to take care of their own people first before they start taking care of, you know, foreigners. And I think Korea had that mentality for a very, very long time. And it's getting better about it now. But I can imagine it was incredibly difficult to break into that community. You remember how hard it was just to speak the language. It's very difficult to practice Korean in Korean because Koreans do not, in general, and again, these are all generalizations and will not hold true, you know, on an individual level. So please don't, you know, crucify me in comments on this. But in general, it's very difficult to speak Korean because they would just speak back to you in English and tell you you're saying it wrong.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's what I mean. And that's why, like, I understand completely where you're coming from, that you spent a long period of time out there. You did have some really good successes. I want to get up, if possible, the promo you did for Red Bull, because I've always, you know, in your commercial work, I always think that's one of your best bits, is that promo you did for them. So, yeah. So, Cole, so where did it go then? So after you got it made, what did you end up doing with it?
So after we got it made, we managed to get a film screening, at the, I think it's called it's actually called KOFIC, which is the Korean Film Institute or something like that.
Awesome.
But yeah, we got to have a premiere and it was awesome. It's one of the reasons why when we went to watch, Shredders at, you know, Clacton Sea or whatever it was, like I felt your giddiness because I remembered so well that moment of seeing it up on the big screen.
That's right, and just so you know, Ed and I often have those moments, like, and that's part of the reason I think we work so well as partners, because Ed has watched me kind of walk through some of what he's already done with these types of things, and that Southend on Sea moment, like, that was a big deal because. And I didn't. I think the reason it's I'm the one that's always telling Ed what's what. You know what I mean? As you can tell from the show, I ramble on for 10 minutes, tell everybody that I know what I'm talking about. But Ed's the kind of guy that knows I don't usually know what I'm talking about, and I just like to talk. So with Southend on Sea, it was like, yeah, you know, we've had films out before. I need some ideas. Demon Ed had come out, and I got really giddy about that. But I didn't get what he was talking about. I was like, I've had films come out before. We had that 1 minute short, and I was fine with that, but. What he was trying to tell me was I had never sat with an audience watching one of my films, and that just was so, so different. So different.
And it's one of the reasons why I was so happy for you when Dandelions went to Fright Fest, and at the same time I was like, oh, but we can't be there, that fucking sucks.
Yeah, I mean, it did, as you know, it has inspired me, and that's been the best part of that. So... You know, from Dandelions, I talked about it with Adam, and I've talked about it before. Yeah, it was. I really wanted to be at the Imperial with, like, Katie Bonham, David Malcolm, all my friends, and being like, hey, I made my first film, guys. And because they were all sending me texts being like, so good, dude. Well done, you know. Because it's a big deal for us. Whether it's good or bad, I'm pretty sure half my friends probably thought it was shit. But, you know, like, in the same sense, they also understood what it took for me to get it together. And they know how badly we all want this.
Anyone who's a filmmaker, like, just... stands and applauds.
It's why, you know, I have to give it a shout out, and if you're hearing this on the day, because this will get posted tomorrow, on Wednesday evening there is a London Horror Society speed pitching event. It's going to be great, guys. I have no idea what they're planning for it, to be honest, and it's the first time they've done it. I don't know how organized it will be, but let me tell you, the London Horror Society is filled with people like us that love making films. That's all they want to do. And so you can walk into an environment like that knowing that no one's going to shit on your ideas. No one's going to say you're stupid. They may question whether you can get it done. You know, Ed does it all the time with me, saying, I'm not sure you're going to be able to do it the way you want to do it. But everyone's there to help. It's why, you know, going back to Benson and Moorhead, indie filmmakers, only guys I know that'll do a director's commentary that literally sets out how they made the film. No one else does that because they're worried you're going to take their job. Listen, we're not going to take any indie director's job. That doesn't work that way. If you're jealous in the industry, it's because you're not successful. It's not because someone is more successful than you. That's the bottom line. And I wish more people would understand that, because it's a lottery, you know? And so, you know, that's all I'm saying is the stuff Ed's talking about, that community, that getting together, that feeling, like, that's why you listen to the show, man. That's why you go do these things, because it's awesome. It's so much better than anything else I know. So any future plans for A Cold Soul? Because obviously there are a lot of mysteries in that one. Is this one that someday you're going to be handing me a treatment on and saying, Jason?
I don't know. It's the kind of thing that I look back on. And I'm like, it wasn't actually that long ago. It feels like so long ago. But, okay, so at the end of the film, like a mysterious character shows up. And the idea was that if anyone found it interesting, or if people were like, hey, let's make some more of these, that it could easily become a serialized kind of thing.
Right.
Now, I liked that idea. But I think I've also grown out of it, and I couldn't really tell you why. But you never know, you know, with these things. No, like when you come up with a character that you like, I think it's normal to you know, kind of ebb and wane. And I'm sure I'll go back to.
It's another thing, Ed, that I'm really struggling to get used to, because it's like the man of a million hobbies is also now I'm the man of a million ideas, but. Yeah, you know, Ed came over to a rather, rather crazy sleepover evening because my wife was out of town. And so it was like, boys are going to play. And we got hammered, like absolutely hammered. And I wrote, it wasn't just me. We wrote like 5 sequels to Dandelions that night. Like it was like this Dandelions universe.
Connected universe.
And I have it all written down, and I could totally script the whole thing out if I needed to. And then I looked at it and I was like, but I don't know if I want to. Like this is a bit over the top.
Again, though, it's the kind of thing that I think you kind of ebb and flow out of. It's like, I think at the time you were very into your kind of folk horror-y kind of stuff. And inevitably that impacted your writing, you know?
And I guess the reason I bring it up, because Adam brought it up and you've brought it up to me before, and I don't always appreciate this, because I like something and I'll just run behind it until I don't like it anymore. That's how I am. your film has to be a bit more thoughtful for that, okay? If you're going to develop something, and this is coming from my own experience, my own, I know this about myself and I do this wrong, like, you've got to pick something you're going to stick with, because you're going to hate this film by the end of it. Even Dandelions, I was so sick of talking about it, even though I still bring it up, because I was like, it was a 5-minute bit I did ages ago. Right now, I'm just so pissed off because all I want is to give you guys another good short, because I've got, like, these concepts. I know they'll look gorgeous, but I can't get them made. And so don't get behind something and say, you know, Ed and I are looking at, today the discussion was on our first feature, because again, Ed's seeing his old work come up, we've got these short ideas, but really for us, the first step is doing that low budget feature that puts us on the map and at least says, now we have a quality film that we can show people to say, you know, we're able to at least execute the way we want to. However, now we have to figure out which one idea do we want to pitch for that. And it's like, well, shit, I don't know. We've got like dozens. And I've got a couple that are treatment, a couple that are not treatment. I've got one or two that are like half scripted. And it's like, well, which one? Do we just do them all? And I, you know, the problem you have, and sorry, I'm rambling here, but because I think it's important. The problem you have is you don't have time to do all of them. And so I'm telling you, the hardest bit I've got right now with Eddie Spaghetti looking on here is trying to figure out, what are we going to do for a feature? Like, what? Which one do we put our egg? Which one do we feel we put our eggs in the basket and go with it? Is it Prisoner 817, because we're making a trailer for that right now, which I've had to push back further, another sense of frustration? Again, I'm telling you all this, listener, not because I want you to feel woeful for us or feel sorry for us. That's not the point of this. This is the fun of it. I live for this kind of anguish. It's just, you should be aware of it, because it's all the stuff that I've stumbled over. And the greatest thing about going through Ed's old films with him is that he did all this before too. So, you know, a lot of times Ed is sitting there saying, Jason, just do this. I tell him to fuck off and I want to do it my way. And well, then we have these conversations.
No, let's be fair. You never tell me directly to fuck off. but you might not necessarily say, yeah, you know what? You're right.
So I had to admit to Eddie like a week ago, because he was like, didn't you read the background of Prisoner 817? I'm like, of course I read it. I just don't think it fits for the... And then like a day later, I had to call him and be like, okay, so I've been really busy, man. And I've watched a lot of it, but I haven't read the whole thing. I'm really sorry. Like, because it happens. And that's what I'm saying. I think my overarching, Jerry's final thought, before I give this over to Ed to close up the show, but Jerry's final thought is, the only thing I've learned is it's all about forward movement. You don't stop. You don't sit and you say, oh, I coulda, shoulda, woulda. Like, if one idea doesn't work, just pick up another and go. And watch films like, you know, Benson and Moorhead's stuff, because they come up with their concepts and then they execute to perfection. Like, at least visually. You know, and they make sure their stories are at least as interesting as they're going to be. That story must have been... They did mention the story was tested out a bunch of times. These are the things you have to do if you're going to take that one idea and make it big. So go out there and do it, guys. You know what I mean? Like, learn from us, listen to us, and don't feel alone. That's, I guess, my ending message. So over to you, Ed. How are we closing this one up?
My battery's low, so bye-bye.
No. Okay, yeah, well, that was pretty much how it was going to be.
The Endless, dude, definitely watch it. It is a wicked mystery with some really cool eldritch horror kind of stuff, timey-wimey stuff to it. Really, really cool. And yeah, Jason's right, man. Like, just keep going. Keep making stuff. Don't give up. Because we all feel down. I'm going through a patch now. And you know, you kind of feel down on yourself that you're not achieving what you want to achieve. But you know, it passes, and the best way to get through it is just to make more content. Make more shit.
That's right. That's right. And you can do that. I guess that's my point, is you can do that. You can do that. You can do that. You don't have to do a feature film. Go out and do something fun. I do it every day. And it tells you, just gets
me
that.
We do the Dirty 20 videos. We do this, you know, we're going to start doing the comic book stuff as well.
That's right. That's right. And Magic the Gathering, if I can get those group a little, you know, Chris Warner, if you ever listen to my show, give me a call. Damn it. But yeah, we've got lots more planned. And Dirty 20, and you're right, way, you know, this podcast were kind of what we used to keep us going. And so maybe you do that. I see a lot of podcasts out there from a lot of people. Like, do them. What does it hurt Great you to idea. Do them? You know what I mean? Great Just idea. If it gets you talking about film and thinking about your ideas, then do it. That's what we do. But anywho, thank you all so much for your time today. We're just about an hour 15, so we've hit about middle of the mark, which is pretty good for us. We hope you've enjoyed the conversation. If you have questions about this one, if you want to know more about Benson and Moorhead, then please put stuff in the comments and we'll get to that. We're going to have more coming to you upcoming weeks. I just don't know what it is yet, and I need to get back to Mitch and Michael about potential interviews on our show, but there's lots more coming. So stick with us. Christmas is coming, and yeah, we'll catch you next time.
Christmas is coming. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. The rising sun. It's been